Welcome to the Resolving Violence Podcast, created to deliver current Canadian prairie-based research on violence and abuse to service providers, people with lived experience, and the general public. I'm Jordan. And if you'd like to learn more about factors that influence violence and the ways you can address them, let's get started.
Today I'm interviewing Candace Klein, historian and PhD candidate in the Department of History at the University of Saskatchewan. Her research fields include queer, gender, legal, and Indigenous histories in Western Canada. She's committed to social justice issues and engages in various community events, public history lectures, and grassroots volunteer opportunities. She's a 2023 recipient of the Everett Baker Award for Saskatchewan Heritage for her thesis research and her work with the Neil Richards Collection of Gender and Sexual Diversity at the University Archives and Special Collections. Her PhD dissertation, titled If My Wife Had Been Home, This Would Never Have Happened, Incest in Saskatchewan, 1901 to 1931, examines the ways that race, ethno-religious identities, gender, and class influence judicial outcomes in cases of incest. I hope you enjoy this episode. Welcome to the podcast, Candace. Thank you for joining me today. You are a PhD candidate. I understand your PhD dissertation is called If My Wife Had Been Home, This Would Never Have Happened, Incest in Saskatchewan, 1901 to 1931. Could you start us off on an overview on what your dissertation is actually about?
Yeah, so I mean, it's in the title in that I'm looking at historical cases of incest in Saskatchewan from when I can find the first real case that's covered in an actual meaningful way by the courts and newspapers in 1901 until I had to have just a cutoff date because there were so many cases, especially with the advent of the Great Depression. So I thought a 30-year span, so 1931, all over the province of Saskatchewan. And what I found was there are 167 cases. The majority of them are charges of incest. There's a couple that are charged under carnal knowledge, but it's by sometimes a charge of incest and carnal knowledge can kind of be conflicted in the law. And in any case, it basically means a close family member, so filial sexual assault. So there are out of 167 cases, four of them are women and the rest are men. And so what I look at is sort of some of the contributing factors to incestuous families. Are there some similarities? What does it look like in terms of the way that literature on incest and sexual violence in families and domestic and gender-based violence? Are there similarities? Are there differences? Is Saskatchewan an exception? Is it par for the course? What do these families look like in terms of ethnicity, but even more important, ethno-religious identity? Are people overrepresented in the data? Are they underrepresented? Who gets punished? Who doesn't? And so those are sort of the things that I look at in this thesis in a very short nutshell, if you will.
I was curious about why you chose the time period 1901 to 1931, but the explanation you offer makes total sense. It's the first recorded case versus 30-year span because you have to cut it off somewhere. I'm curious, have you done any research into more modern or more recent cases of incest in the province?
No, that's more of a sociological or gender-based approach in gender studies. And so because I'm a historian, I want to look sort of in the past. But I will say I didn't set out to research this. It happened. The sources came to me. I actually was searching queer history instead. I was looking for men and women in the court system who would have been charged with things like sodomy, gross indecency, buggery, basically, you know, the charges under crimes against morality for same-sex sexual relations, relationships, and things. And so when I was browsing through the criminal files, I kept on seeing incest, incest, incest. And I was something just was nagging at me. And I said, you know, what's going on here? Why are there so many cases? And so I did a little bit of digging into, you know, who had written around similar time periods in Canada. And there was Dorothy Chun's work on British Columbia and Joan Sangster's work in Ontario. And those are kind of in the same time periods. And I thought, well, you know, they all have 40 cases or less. why does Saskatchewan seem to have double, triple, quadruple to some of that data? And it really just made me so curious. And that's how I went in there. And so, yeah, it was totally happenstance, but sort of that time period was just also because I was looking at different sex crime cases in that same time period already, looking at early queer history and like sort of the settlement era. And it just, the volume of cases and pulling some of those cases, I just thought, I have to tell this story. No one's told this story. And the story is actually very relevant for, and really, I'm sure, was life-changing for 167 people, like truly.
So I hate to ask you to try to compress what is presumably years of research into like a pithy minute-long soundbite, but do you have any insights you're able to share as to why there are so many cases in Saskatchewan as opposed to other provinces and territories in the country?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that's really like the question that I've been trying to figure out. And I was wanting to figure out why. And, you know, as I was doing this research more and more, I was thinking, you know, I don't think I can answer the question of why, but because I don't know the intentions behind these people and these families. But I do know that there are conditions that create a violent home. And I think it's important to understand that, you know, when we talk about incest, we don't talk about filial sexual violence, like in gender-based violence, in domestic violence and family violence. It's not as commonplace. We think about physical violence. We think about, you know, psychological, emotional, mental, verbal. And it's a really taboo subject to bring in sexual violence. But what I'm finding is that it's just an extension of a larger web of family violence, because every single incestuous family, there's other forms of violence going on. It's not the only form. And in fact, most of the perpetrators of sexual violence, in fact, almost all, something like 98% of these cases, there is a threat that to the victim that if you tell anyone, I will kill you. And there's an intense fear of really intense physical violence beyond the sexual violence that they've experienced. There's verbal threats. Quite often, when you see father-daughter incest, the men in the household, if their mothers are still around, he often beats his mother. There's a few cases where I have the incestuous father actually go to jail for what they called quote unquote wife beating, which was incredibly rare at the time, but it's in several of my cases. So it just shows that it's part of this larger web, and there are certain conditions that bring that about. So that's sort of a long winded answer to that. Second, I think that there's something unique in Saskatchewan in that we do have a higher policing and surveillance system in the prairies and in Saskatchewan compared to other provinces.
Oh, that's an interesting angle. So this is a little bit less necessarily that there's something unique to Saskatchewan that cultivates conditions of incest, and potentially a bit more that we have more of a system for recording it. We have more of a system for identifying it, maybe, or...
Yeah, it could be. I mean, you know, I will say that the province was very religious historically. And so there does seem to be a correlation between religiosity and violence. You have the more intense and the more religious a family, the higher chance it seems like there's going to be some kind of domestic or family gender-based violence therein. So there are some unique conditions in terms of that, as well as there is some insular ethno-religious identities happening in Saskatchewan that the populations here aren't comparable to other places. It's unique demographic of people here, but also the fact that there are a greater number of police. So especially with the Northwest Mounted Police coming here specifically to do the federal will and be this federal representation, the feds were really terrified of Indigenous uprisings and resistance, which they had been successfully campaigning against for hundreds of years and continuing to do so today. So you have this higher concentration of police here. This could be one of these things as well. And so you have people sort of unable to get away with it. And also because it is more insular, it's more gossipy. People are way more in your business here. You don't really have privacy like you might in Ontario or you might have in British Columbia. And so you have more people willing to go to the police when they suspect something's going on. And especially because a lot of them are resulting in pregnancies, there's a good proportion of the cases where the victim becomes pregnant. And so it's really difficult to hide that from, at the very least, the community or other family members who are not going to put up with that. Also, I would say the demographics, there's this real influx specifically of white and Eastern European women in the early 1900s that really booms the population, whereas in British Columbia, it still stays pretty heavily male-centric. And so there might be some population demographics there. So there's like seems to be, it's not really an easy answer in terms of why does Saskatchewan have this number. It's sort of like a collection of reasons. And ultimately, yeah, you know, that's a question that I still can't really answer. And I'd like to, but my thesis is kind of focusing more so on sentencing patterns, ethno-religious identities, the way that those things play out in the court system. And you have to understand, too, that in the early 20th century, Saskatchewan's court systems were a real hodgepodge and boys club, if you will. You know, the judges did their best to appoint the rule of law in their rulings, but, you know, it seems pretty clear that there's really intense bias against specific victims of incest.
Are you able to go into more detail about that?
Right. So the way that sexual violence and the way that it's prosecuted in the law is pretty much unchanged since the late 1800s in the Canadian Criminal Code. It really hasn't changed too much in that the way that these crimes are prosecuted, the victim's on trial. And quite often in these cases, what you see is that it's not whether or not the crime occurred. It's whether or not it actually injured the victim's character. Was she asking for it? We sort of think of today, but, you know, did she have a chaste moral character before the incident occurred? And some victims were deemed as, yes, being more pure than others. And this was largely based around class, ethno-religious identity, and race. So one thing that I thought would happen was Indigenous perpetrators of incest and filial sexual assault, I thought that they would have longer sentences compared to, say, a white Anglo-Saxon, right? Like a Anglo-Protestant. And I found that it was the opposite. The closer to whiteness, the harsher the punishment for the perpetrator of sexual violence. So I was like, okay, that's interesting. What's going on here? And then I realized I was looking at it from the wrong way. I'm looking at the perpetrator. But instead, I actually need to be examining the victim. Because especially for racialized or Indigenous victims, the law couldn't care about them. So an Indigenous girl or woman was seen as being racially impure, being racially inferior. And Indigenous women were not considered by white Anglo-Saxon Canadians, and especially judiciaries, as possessing any kind of moral aptitude, just by their ethnicity, right? There's this genocidal campaign in the residential school system that's very clear in that there's government policies. And so when an Indigenous victim is in this court system for being sexually assaulted by her father or her brother or her uncle, her assault is seen as pretty much inconsequential. And so when an Indigenous perpetrator of incest is even convicted, if at all convicted, I see sentences like 6 days, 9 days, 3 months. And conversely, for, say, a German Mennonite farmer, I see 15 years, 7 years. I see 30 lashes. I see all these sort of longer prison sentences, much more harsher corporal punishments. You know, the average for, say, a British Canadian some kind of Protestant religion is about 3 years. Whereas, you know, racialized people, it's a couple of weeks on average. And when I cross-reference the data with the larger sex crime data set that we have, it's very clear that it's quantitatively important and that there's something going on in the data that shows that, yes, racialized victims of sexual assault in general are considered lesser than in the courts, but especially when it comes to incest, there's hardly any punishment meted out to the perpetrator. So people might think, oh, that's really strange because Indigenous people at that time were heavily policed. Yet, they were facing sort of these sentences that were totally out of proportion with the offense. And that's so true when you look at things like horse stealing or like any kind of theft. You look at sort of vagrancy charges. You know, a bushel of wheat held more value in the court system than an Indigenous woman. And that is very clear from what I have seen in the data in these cases. So, you know, for example, there's one Indigenous man who was charged with incest against his daughter, and he was found guilty and he had a 9-day sentence in the Regina jail. And then several months later, he was charged with stealing several bushels of wheat and he received 1.5 years.
Oh.
So,
wow.
Yeah, there's a huge discrepancy there that the wheat is more valuable than his daughter. And it was the same judge. And I was looking at the trial transcripts thinking, oh, well, maybe because he had a previous charge, it might have influenced to be like a longer, that wasn't even considered. There was no mention of any previous charge in that court transcript.
I think a lot of people are conscious of the fact that there's a different way that women have historically been valued compared to other, I don't know, properties from the time, but it's shocking to see it laid out so starkly like that. Like, you have such a direct comparison you can make, and it really confronts you with how women have historically been treated. Not the most eloquent way of saying it, but it's shocking.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I treat this as a part of the larger growing body of evidence and discussion that, you know, today's and past and present and unfortunate future, though we're working against this, you know, with our epidemic against murdered and missing Indigenous women, girls, and Two-Spirit people, the government is 100% complicit in that. And I have evidence for that in these court systems, in the way that the government and judiciaries sanction violence against Indigenous women and against racialized women in general, but especially against Indigenous women. So this is just adding to that larger discussion that's being put forth by really brilliant Indigenous scholars and feminist scholars talking about the origins of this being as far back as the Discovery Doctrine, really gaining speed in the fur trade, gaining momentum in the fur trade, and then really being solidified by provincial and federal courts saying, yeah, that violence is totally fine.
Normally, one of the questions we would ask would be, is there anything in your research that you feel is important for others to be aware of that maybe doesn't get as much attention as it should? But from what you're saying about your dissertation, it sounds like almost the entire thing has been shaped by that sort of desire to call to attention, like what has been silenced and what has been overlooked, like specifically in the cases of Indigenous women, Indigenous histories.
For sure, yeah.
We usually do try to direct episodes of this podcast to messages for service providers that they can take with them going forward. So I'm going to try putting that to you. If you were to give service providers a practice to work towards in the long term, what would it be? Is there anything simple or direct that service providers could theoretically start doing right now that relates in some way to the work that you've been doing?
Right. That's the $1 million question.
It really
is. Well, first of all, we're operating in a province that has, you know, unfortunately taken the top three spots for domestic and gender-based violence for many, many years. And as I'm seeing, maybe historically since its inception as a province, and yet we have no actual government mandated policies to address these issues. So right away, I mean, part of the people working in this, and I'm sure this is, you know, preaching to the choir essentially, is really this practice is political. And, you know, understanding that it's not just an issue of presentism, it's really a huge issue of the past. And in fact, in order to make sense of the present and the future, we really have to examine our past. That's one of, I think, a historian's most important jobs, is to help people understand what's going on presently by showing you sources of the past to help that context develop. So I would say, you know, educate yourselves on the history of this, because it doesn't just happen out of nowhere. And I know there's lots of resources being developed in terms of people being able to educate themselves, understanding colonial histories, understanding histories of gender and sexuality, but really putting in time and effort. And maybe there can be things that are a part of those positions in terms of historical education and sort of something around some kind of education to understand, you know, these are the historical trajectories and this is what happens, to sort of better understand maybe their clients today, and to understand that across all ethnicities, across all ethno-religious cultures, that, you know, this is really long-term intergenerational violence. And there are 167 different families from 1901 to 1931 that are caught up in this. But knowing how that works, how many thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of people have actually been affected by this in the larger family branch, right? It shows that, you know, the origins of this province for almost like for hundreds of people were really violent and really traumatizing. And so that really informs the way the province grows and moves and shakes today. And so for me, yeah, I would just offer, you know, my biased viewpoint is education and understanding the history of this and where it comes from in order to actually accurately address things appropriately today.
All right. So we are approaching the end of the questions we usually try to go through here. So I want to put one last one to you. Do you have any final thoughts or final remarks that you would like to share with our listeners?
You know, I think that this topic, and when I tell people that what I work on, the history of incest, you know, I don't think I've ever been met with a person who hasn't been shocked at what it is I do, and thinking, wow, okay. You know, like that's pretty wild to be involved in that. And now for 5.5 years, it can be pretty tough on the psyche. But I will say that I feel very much the work that I'm doing, I feel like it's a privilege, because I'm able to tell the stories. And granted, everyone is anonymized in this, but I do have the raw data. And if people ever wanted to approach me and see if their family is in it, you know, you're welcome to, but it's not out there for public display in terms of people won't be able to be readily identified. But, you know, it really is an honor and a privilege to tell the stories of these people, because, you know, 167 people's lives were forever changed as they were children growing up. Absolutely, you know, their trust and love was destroyed by the people that they trusted and loved most. And society was told was the safest place for women and children was the home. And it just isn't. It wasn't for a lot of people. And so I definitely do feel a sense of privilege in this tough work to be able to tell these stories and to let, you know, victims of past, present, and who will be future, unfortunately, you know, that their stories do matter. Their stories matter, that they're not alone. And, you know, there are all these things in the past that can maybe help them deal with things in the present. And, you know, to talk about this openly and to sort of take away that shame that seems to be blanketed across all the victims in my sources, you know, it's very clear there's a lot of shame in the court transcripts and trial testimonies. And just know that, you know, that shame is not yours to carry. That's not it, but it is historically something I've seen. And just, yeah, sorry, I guess I'm all over the place with that. But yeah, basically I just feel like, you know, it's a privilege to do this work, and it's tough work, but I think it's worth it. It's worthwhile. I think it's really important. And it kind of opens up a larger wound of the province that I don't think we've dealt with properly. As we can see from today's rates of sexual and domestic and gender-based violence, like it's out of control in this province. It really is. And so I think, I hope, in part of this dissertation, can at the very least create a conversation to start to open these wounds. And because, you know, it needs air to heal, and you can't do that when it's trapped. So that's sort of what I hope this does.
That's a really beautiful way of putting that. I think that it's likely that a dissertation would definitely get a conversation going. And our hope with the podcast is that it's a way of kind of broadcasting those ideas. So hopefully we'll get to play a part in getting those ideas circulating. It's been a pleasure talking to you today, Candace. So thank you so much for joining us. And we'll definitely be looking forward to following your work in the future and seeing where the dissertation ends up going.
For sure. I definitely hope to actually publish it in an article that people can actually read, because dissertations, let's be honest, they can be boring to read. They're too long. They're usually poorly written. So hoping to get just a small article to get people interested.
We'll be looking forward to it. We're going to keep an eye out. We're going to encourage all of our listeners to keep an eye out too.
Thank you for joining us for another episode of Resolving Violence. If you're interested in learning more about today's guests and their research or Resolve Saskatchewan, please check the show notes below. And if what you listened to today was helpful, please consider sharing it with colleagues and on social media so we can work collectively to resolve violence. Thanks again. Until next time.